Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, March 7th. I'm Allison Kolb, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, activists under scrutiny allege that Cal Poly has stifled free speech with recent arrests of protesters in Arcata. Hundreds march in Sacramento for more education funding. And the KMUD News Sports Report. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. University activists in Arcata are accusing Cal Poly Humboldt and local law enforcement of suppressing dissent through felony conspiracy charges following the arrest of two protesters who participated in a march and demonstration in January. Details about the vandalism are unclear, and students are fearful of retaliation for protest activities in the fallout of last year's student occupation in April. Freelance reporter Ryan Hudson has the story.
Activists and students at Cal Poly Humboldt are speaking out against two recent arrests made by the university's police department accusing activists in the community of conspiracy to commit crimes, vandalism, and unlawful use of a mask in commission of a crime, allegedly. In response, community activists in Arcata are accusing the university of suppressing dissent in the wake of last spring's campus protest and occupation of Siemens Hall, which garnered national attention and put a negative spotlight on the university's administrators for their heavy-handed response, bringing police to what activists say would have simply been a peaceful sit-in, not unlike previous political protests in the university's history. The two arrests made by university police were related to a January 21st protest march, which saw students and non-student community activists marching through the Cal Poly campus against the new Trump administration just one day after its inauguration. With banners, signs, drums, and megaphones, the group of roughly 40 protesters made their dissent known across the campus, even entering buildings and causing minor disruptions while moving through the campus grounds. The controversy here stems from the arrest of the two protesters, both familiar to the mutual aid activist community in Arcata, Maggie Raish and Raymond Evans, a week after the demonstration held on January 21st. That demonstration was part of a nationwide movement with students and community members rallying against policies of the incoming Trump administration. This was dubbed the Festival of Resistance, and it was a grassroots effort brought together by activists focused on the issues of police militarization and climate justice. Roughly 1 month after the arrest of Maggie Raish and Raymond Evans, the group issued a press release explaining the circumstances of the arrest, calling the development purposely vague and considering the arrest to be part of a growing effort to repress opposition to various elements of government oppression. Being focused on those issues related to the protest, personal freedoms of expression, and civil rights. Members of the group, Friends of Raymond and Maggie, have released a statement claiming that the activists are being unfairly targeted due to their political beliefs. They are urging community members to push back against the Humboldt County District Attorney's Office, which is considering prosecuting the two protesters. The group describes the proposed charges of felony conspiracy, vandalism, and unlawful use of a mask as, quote, absurd and inflated. They allege that the arrest strategies used by university police echo a broader pattern of repressing dissent despite the university's public image of progressive ideals. They allege that officers had been monitoring Raish and Evans prior to obtaining arrest warrants, with accusations of intimidation tactics employed against them. Lending credence to the perspective of activists who are concerned about civil liberties and freedom to protest on college campuses, President Trump's recent statement on social media threatening funding for schools, which have seen pro-Palestine protests and threatening deportation of foreign students who have participated in those protests, has further validated their cause for concern. The two recent arrests in Arcata are viewed by student activists as strategic to avoid public scrutiny in light of past protests at Siemens Hall in April of last year, where some student activists suffered injuries at the hands of local police called to the scene by university administrators. They argue that the university aims to handle dissent on campus with minimal public attention to avoid media scrutiny in hopes of avoiding negative publicity. Activists have expressed concern that the university police's recommended charge of essentially wearing a mask while committing an act of vandalism or other crime is an authoritarian response aimed at stifling protests. However, the university points out that wearing a mask in the commission of a crime is what makes wearing the mask illegal. One student activist who wanted to remain anonymous for fear of academic repercussions told us, "This is about more than just arrests. It is about silencing our voices." In response to concerns raised by friends of Raymond and Maggie, Cal Poly University released this statement. Quote, "University police can confirm that they were arrested for vandalism, conspiracy, and masked while committing a crime. To be clear, wearing a mask itself is not a crime or a violation of university policy, but it becomes both when doing so for the purposes of concealment of identity when violating the law," in parentheses. The statement continues. Quote, "The university not only supports freedom of speech, regardless of the content of that speech, but we protect it and encourage all voices to be heard. The CSU's interim time, place, and manner policy, which the university has shared widely with the campus community and explained in multiple announcements, exists to protect everyone's First Amendment rights while also protecting the right to learn and work in a safe environment. Understanding that balance is key," reads the statement. And it continues, quote, "We've seen a number of protests on campus with dozens of people in attendance since the beginning of the school year where participants have followed time, place, and manner policy. In the case of the January 21st event, the two individuals were arrested for the alleged criminal activity on campus, not because they were engaged in free speech. Beyond that, we cannot comment further on an ongoing investigation." Unquote. Whether the district attorney's office will choose to prosecute these two cases remains to be seen. Reporting for KMUD News, this is Ryan Hudson at Humboldt Freelance Reporting.
KMUD is currently holding its spring membership drive with the theme, Education by the People, for the People. This week, KMUD News is highlighting this theme and those who put it into action here on the North Coast and beyond. Tonight, we feature Amada Lang, a Karuk, Wiat, and Konamihu Shasta native, cultural storyteller, and Indigenous recreation professional. She works with Native youth and ancestral homeland in Humboldt County, focusing on inclusive outdoor therapy for underserved communities. Amada is the Klamath Basin Coordinator at Rios to Rivers and co-founded Pa'ama, a kayak club for Native youth in the lower Klamath Basin, supporting the first descent paddle with the Paddle Tribal Waters Program. Sigur Bjorn brings you the details.
Amada Lang is the Director of Outdoor Adventure and Cultural Education at Rios to Rivers, an international program that seeks to connect Indigenous youth with their local waters and support them to become environmental stewards. This summer, Lang will lead a group of local youth on a 30-day journey down the Klamath River. The event, referred to as the First Descent, will be the first source-to-sea trek on the Klamath since the river was dammed in the early 20th century. The trip has been long in the making, and some of the youth involved have been training for it for 4 years. Chemist Lauren Schmidt spoke to Lang about this historical event and about her work for Rios to Rivers.
The first descent will be starting on June 12th, and we'll be starting up near Wood River, and pretty much, yeah, it's going to be legitimate source to sea, and we're going to be using sea kayaks some of the time and then transferring into our boats. 30 days out on the water without just straight keep on going, it's going to be quite a wild ride. And I know there's some of our kiddos that have the skill set to do the entire descent, and some students will be joining in at different times. And so we're definitely going to have at least 5 to 6 community events. And so there'll be one at the start, and for sure on June 12th, and one at the end, which will be July 12th. And so the July 12th will be a really big one to look out for. That one will be a celebration for the community at the mouth of the Klamath. And we're still hashing out those details, but it's going to be food, celebratory music, people coming from all over. A lot of these students now have been, some of them have been in the program since they were 14 and they're turning 18. Some of them in the program, they're 12, they're turning 16. And so this is some of their formative years that they're really getting to have these inner exchanges with other tribal students and kiddos around the region. I realize that our kids have a amplified voice through that movement, but just the way that they carry themselves as Indigenous practitioners, even at a young age, going to ceremony, practicing cultural ways, being kind and courteous to your elders at events, being an example for the younger youth when we're on trips, you just even being an advocate for fellow students. These kiddos that are part of our programs have kind of been on the river their whole life. River is been that space for me growing up as a Native person. It's always been there. You don't have to pay to go there. You don't have to, you just, it's your family spot. You grow up and you kind of, that's just a norm for me at least. And I see that through some of our youth, and that natural way of growing up on the river has really just, you can see that comfort in kayaking with these students. And the natural stewardship and allyship just comes in with being, I think, a Native person and where we come from and the fights that we've had or seen or know from our home communities. Ruby's an example. She hasn't been back to Happy Camp since her end of junior year. Her last semester, her second semester junior year, she basically got into our Paddle Tribal Waters program, went to Chile, and the PNW, and then had summer, and then she got accepted into another world-class kayak academy program, and her and another student from Hoopaw were accepted. They fundraised, worked really hard to go on their own, and they were accepted into another traveling kayak high school program on their own. And so that inspired them to do that on their own, and they went to Africa and Canada earlier this year, last year. It's inspiring our kids to continue their education, but it's also allowing them to really map out how they want their education while they're doing something that's fulfilling. And that's what I've realized for these kids is that providing them something that is so much of an opportunity is you're seeing how much they want that, and their parents, and it's just a trickling effect. And I'm super stoked to be a part of it.
As monumental as the removal of the 4 dams on the Klamath was, Lang emphasizes that the work is not done, and she sees the paddle club as the ideal vehicle for it.
After this initial idea of the first descent, I thought that there could be a long-lasting club in our community, and our kids are really taking to the sport, and it's a new way to almost be a recreation professional, but also uplifting your cultural identity and yourself as a professional and your culture through it. What I've learned through this with Indigenous stewardship and dam removal internationally and locally, Rios has really given me the opportunity to grasp the way that dams really affect Indigenous populations, and not just ours. I am very, very stoked on this the stewardship opportunities that are coming through with the first ascent happening, but it's also allowing us to see that there is still more of a fight with all of this happiness. And I'm stoked that we're paddling from source to sea. We're going to be going with the fish legitimately to the mouth. And so that is going to be super powerful in itself. But I do like to bring up that it's in technicality, it's not all free flowing. One of our team members is very, very high up on Chiloquin, Klamath Modoc, and they're still dealing with the upper two dams. And so it is a free-flowing river from source to sea in the sense of where we're starting. But I do like one of our staff really brought it up and was like, well, we're still dealing with this fight up here with these other dams. And I definitely think the paddle clubs will keep on pushing for more movements in the sense of dam removal and protesting dams, along with just having healthy, clean flowing rivers.
In state news, hundreds march in Sacramento for more education funding. Suzanne Potter reports.
The event was part of a nationwide day of action sponsored by the American Federation of Teachers. Stephanie Luna, a student at East Los Angeles Community College, says she supports Assembly Bill 537, which would allow 2 years of free community college tuition for part-time students. Right now, the College Promise program is only open to people who take a full course load.
We know that the majority of California community college students are part-time. For the students that have to work or that have to take care of families, they're also deserving of access to a higher education the same way that full-time students are.
Speakers also called for full funding for higher education in the next state budget currently under negotiation. And with the state and federal budgets in flux, Republicans in Congress are proposing huge cuts to Medicaid. The Trump administration is also threatening to pull federal funding from schools that use race as a factor in policy or programming. Sociology professor James McKeever with Pierce College in Los Angeles says courses that touch on diversity, equity, and inclusion are important to a well-rounded education.
We're really trying to ensure that we're teaching an accurate, diverse history. Too often our history books have left out the accomplishments of women, of people of color, and the queer people. And we want to make sure that those people get remembered and recognized.
Speakers at the march also called on lawmakers to fend off any tuition increases and to prioritize fair compensation and equitable working conditions for campus employees. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Mexico lawsuit against U.S. gun makers reaches Supreme Court, alleges gun makers cashing in on cartel violence. Christopher Martinez reports.
It sounds like the title of an old spaghetti western movie, Smith and Wesson versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos, but it's actually a $10 billion lawsuit that Mexico filed against top U.S. gun manufacturers, alleging that they've fueled cartel gun violence in Mexico. A lower court had allowed the case to move forward in spite of U.S. laws that largely shield gun makers from lawsuits. The gun makers appealed, and the Supreme Court heard oral arguments Tuesday. Former U.S. Solicitor General, now private attorney Noel Francisco, argued on behalf of the gun makers.
Indeed, if Mexico is right, then every law enforcement organization in America has missed the largest criminal conspiracy in history operating right under their nose, and Budweiser is liable for every accident caused by underage drinkers, since it knows that teenagers will buy beer, drive drunk, and crash. The First Circuit gravely erred in embracing that implausible theory and should be reversed.
Mexico has strict gun laws, and it has just one store where people can legally buy firearms. But thousands of guns are smuggled in by the country's powerful drug cartels each year. The Mexican government says at least 70% of those weapons come from the United States. Lawyer Catherine Stetson argued on behalf of Mexico, saying Mexico should be given a chance to prove its case.
The complaint details that petitioners deliberately supply the illegal Mexican market by selling guns through the small number of dealers that they know sell a large number of crime guns and who repeatedly sell in bulk to the cartel traffickers.
Mexico's arguments faced a skeptical court, with both liberal and conservative justices seeming to think the complaint runs afoul of U.S. shield laws. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson is one of the more liberal members of the court.
I mean, if you look at your lawsuit and what you're asking for. You're asking for changes to the firearm industry safety practices. You say not, you know, putting these kinds of constraints is a thing that should be give rise to liability. The distribution practices, the marketing, all of the things that you asked for in this lawsuit would amount to different kinds of regulatory constraints that I'm thinking Congress didn't want the courts to be the ones to impose.
On the other end of the political spectrum, Justice Samuel Alito asked a question he said may be on the minds of ordinary Americans that hear about the case.
Mexico says that U.S. gun manufacturers are contributing to illegal conduct in Mexico. There are Americans who think that Mexican government officials are contributing to a lot of illegal conduct here. So suppose that one of the 50 states sued the government of Mexico for aiding and abetting illegal conduct within the state's borders that causes the state to incur law enforcement costs, public welfare costs, other costs.
The case began 4 years ago when the Mexican government filed its blockbuster lawsuit against some of the biggest gun companies in the U.S., including Smith & Wesson, Beretta, Colt, and Glock, Inc. It's just coincidental that it's coming up for a hearing now, as President Donald Trump has raised tariffs on Mexican imports. The High Court is expected to issue its ruling by late June. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Ray Hamill brings us details on all of this week's big local sports stories, including why it was a big week for two Humboldt County high school basketball teams, some big news for local MMA, and a record-setting week for one former South Fork club in this report.
A pair of HTNL teams have been crowned North Coast Section champions in basketball after a big week on the courts for the local league. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on that story in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including how all the HTNL playoff basketball teams fared, why it was a memorable week for Cal Poly Humboldt basketball, some big news for local MMA, and how one former South Fork High athlete is enjoying a big start to the college track and field season. But first up, two local high school teams have been crowned NCS champions in basketball. On Saturday night, the Ferndale girls and St. Bernard's boys each won their Division 6 championship games to continue their recent postseason success. The Wildcats, who were seeded number one in their bracket, welcomed Cornerstone Christian to Ferndale for a Saturday night championship showdown, and they held on late for a 53-51 win in front of a packed gymnasium, securing their second section crown in 4 years and showcasing just why they are now an NCS powerhouse. The section championship is the program's fifth all-time, which ties St. Bernard's for most ever by an HTNL girls team in basketball. All five of those championships have come in the past 13 seasons, and no other HTNL girls team can match that level of success in recent times. And they achieved it with a strong defensive team performance and an offense that did just enough to outplay a very good Cornerstone Christian team. Madison Gossie scored a team-high 15 points in the win, while teammate Michaela Ellsmore added 13 points, including 3 three-pointers, and Clara Albee chipped in 7 points. The Wildcats advanced to this week's NorCal Division 6 tournament and received the number one seed in the 8-team bracket. They opened the state playoffs on Wednesday night at home against Fall River, but lost 55-52 in an exciting overtime showdown to end their season. The Wildcats had to play without influential junior guard Tinley Pigeon, who suffered an injury in the final minute of the NCS final. They started strong and led for much of the game before a clutch three-pointer by the visitors with just 27 seconds remaining in the fourth quarter tied things up and forced overtime. The extra period was back and forth, but the Fall River girls would hit another clutch three late in overtime to secure the victory and send them on to the NorCal semi-finals. Ellsmore had a huge night and finished with a game-high 29 points, including a remarkable 9 three-pointers. The Cats closed out the season with a record of 17-10 and should be back as strong as ever next year, with just one starting senior on this year's junior heavy roster. It was also a big week for the St. Bernard's boys, who also won a second NCS championship in four seasons. The Crusaders, who also were seeded number one in their D6 bracket, welcomed St. Vincent de Paul to Eureka for the championship game and prevailed 56-39. The win was a relatively easy one for the Crusaders, who had the game well in hand for much of the second half and led by as many as 20 points midway through the fourth quarter. Four different St. Bernard's players finished with at least 9 points in the win, showcasing the balance on a championship team that features no seniors, including the always dangerous Liam Dyer, who scored a team-high 20 points in the win and surpassed the 1,000 career points mark. Junior Prince Latimer added 9 points, 5 rebounds and 3 steals with what could have been his best game of the year. The section title is the 6th all-time for the St. Bernard's boys, which is the most ever by any HDNL basketball program, boys or girls. After the championship win, the Crusaders received the number 3 seed for the NorCal Division 6 playoffs, and they won their tournament opener on Wednesday night, defeating Biggs 90-57 with another dominating performance. The win sets up a semi-final showdown at number 2 Stone Ridge Christian on Saturday night. Dyer scored a team-high 18 points in Wednesday's win and also had 5 rebounds, while Latimer added 14 points, 7 assists and 5 steals. Saturday night's game is set for 7 p.m. and a win will leave the Crusaders just one victory from a second NorCal title in 4 seasons. The SB boys are the last remaining HDNL team, boys or girls, still playing this season after 2 other league teams lost their NorCal openers on Tuesday night. After cruising to a 54-29 win over Fortuna in the NCS Division 3 third place game last Friday night, the St. Bernard's girls received the number 11 seed in the Division 3 bracket in the NorCal tournament, but would lose at number 6 Menlo School on Tuesday night by a score of 45-41. The loss ended a memorable season for the Little Four and Dick Nicolai tournament champions, who closed out with a record of 29-3. The Fortuna girls also qualified for the NorCal playoffs and were seeded number 14 in the Division 4 tournament, but they also fell at the first hurdle on Tuesday night, losing at number 3 Rio Linda 47-38. It was a memorable playoff run for the Huskies, who went further in the postseason than any other Fortuna girls team since 1981, and they won back-to-back road playoff games in the NCS. Elsewhere in local sports this week, the Cal Poly Humboldt men's basketball team won its CCAA tournament opener on Thursday, defeating Cal Poly Pomona 70-52 at San Marcos. The Jacks received the number 4 seed in the tournament after finishing 4th in the regular season conference standings. In local mixed martial arts news, Humboldt County's Cass Bell announced last weekend that he will make his long-awaited comeback at the Bear River Casino and Resort Fight Night on May 3rd. The 37-year-old Bell, who has fought several times at Bellator events, is 8-3 as a pro and will be fighting for the first time since November 2023. And finally this week, former South Fork Cub Chase McFarland enjoyed a record-breaking performance for College of the Redwoods track and field last weekend at Shasta. The CR sophomore set a new school record in the women's hammer with a throw of 143 feet 4 inches. And that's this week's Caymud News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.